This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor of Music and Piano, Howard Karp. Today is April 18th, 2006. Howard, we wanted to continue this interview by asking you your observations about the development and evolution of the School of Music, your observations about it, from the time that you came until today.
Mm-hmm. I would say that when I came in 1972, I was aware that the music school wasn't as far along in its development compared to the music school at the University of Illinois. In fact, it was called a music school, but it didn't really have its own administration over the budget. So it was more a department of music, even though it was called a school of music. It was part of the LNS, which it still is. And although there have been many discussions about it becoming a true school of music, I don't think that's something that's in the works. And the discussion, as I lived here for 28 years, just began to die out, and we didn't talk about it anymore. And I think one of the reasons that we didn't talk about it was that we were resigned to the fact that it would never become its own school of music, administering its own budget, but that the school was improving to the extent that we were all much happier with how things were developing. And I certainly was aware that after being here for maybe a half dozen years, that things did improve. I felt that there was a certain feeling of inferiority amongst many of the faculty members. I happened to be in a department within the school that really balked at having a DMA, a doctorate in applied music, a trend that became more and more common within major universities. At first it was very controversial, but I know in the School of Music there was at least one of my colleagues in piano, say, that was a graduate of Indiana, and he felt that the Wisconsin wasn't ready for such a degree, and really did discourage students from embarking on that degree, at least within his studio. And as a result, I guess I benefited, because more and more students gravitated to my studio that wanted to accomplish a doctorate, and they were amongst my most successful students. Mm-hmm. We had, when I came, a good director of the school. I think he was intelligent and made me feel very welcome.
Who was that?
Very kind. That was Bruce Benward.
Oh.
And before him, before I came, it was a member of the voice department who came to a very tragic end here. It was one of the lowest moments in the School of Music. Dale Gilbert took his own life. A very tragic situation that many of us, especially in May when it happened, find it hard to live through that anniversary. It was just one of those supreme tragedies. He, who did a great deal for the school when he was director, in fact, I think did more than any other single person from making the school, developing the school from a very, like, sleeping giant, as my distinguished colleague Robert Fountain would call the music department here, to becoming a rather outstanding department. Then we had a difficult time, I would say, but we were able to emerge from it when when my colleague, well, we've had wonderful people in more recent years. John Schaefer is the director now, and he's in his second term and doing very well. And he was preceded by a wonderful, wonderful director, our tubist John Stevens, who is a very gifted composer and an outstanding tubist. But both of those men were very brilliant, and they had youth, and they had the heart of the school in mind, and they were wonderful people to have as administrators and wonderful to work for. And I think they did a lot to bring the school back to a level that, that one could be very proud. And I would say today, after my retirement, I'm my fifth year of retirement, the school is probably as fine as it ever was. Mm-hmm. And look, you know, it's interesting when one is a retired faculty member and looks back upon other people who are retired and what their relation to the school is, remains, what hopes they have for the school in the future, even though they have nothing to do with it in certain ways. I've noticed that many people, many faculty members who speak in very voluble terms during their tenure at faculty meetings and seem to have the school at heart, once they're retired, they're just out of it completely. It seems very strange to me that that occurs, because I was someone that didn't contribute a great deal to faculty member to faculty meetings. I voted and I had opinions and I voiced them, but I didn't dominate. And yet the school means a great deal to me today, and I try to attend as many concerts as an emeritus faculty member and participate in as many things as I think I can today. And I just know there are many people who once they're retired, are just gone and don't think of the school or don't seem to participate in any way or find any interest in the school once they're retired. It's just maybe human nature. I don't know.
Howard, would you comment on the evolution and development as you saw it of the various faculty performing ensembles of the school? Well, there's the Pro Arti and the Wingra, yeah, yes, and the Brass Quintet.
I was always impressed with their dedication from the time I came here. Chamber music seemed to be of number one importance in the school, and these organizations, these small ensembles, were a very vital part of the school from the beginning. There are other institutions that I've been associated with in which that was less intense than it is here. And I mean, there was no doubt when I came to the University of Wisconsin from the University of Illinois, I was going to a school that was less developed. Uh-huh. But one of the true attractions for me in coming to Wisconsin was the fact that they had a string quartet in residence, and they were basically my age or younger, and that excited me a lot. Two of the members of the quartet were exactly my age, and two were younger, and the quartet that was in residence at the University of Illinois was about to retire when I left, and I knew it would not be replaced. And that was one of the reasons that made the change to hear something a little more graceful and easy for me, even though I was coming to a school where I knew at first I would not have as fine a class as I had at Illinois. That changed very rapidly, and which I was very, very thankful for. And any doubts that I had at the beginning about making the move, I disappeared, as I think I mentioned before. But the ensembles here all received, or most of them received credit for their practicing. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of unique. Mm-hmm. in my experience. The quartet at the University of Illinois did receive credit, but as a group, they weren't as intense in their teaching as the people here were. Mm-hmm. And I've admired all the groups here, the brass quintet, and the choral groups, and the string groups, and the wind groups a lot. And I've participated a lot with the strings, and some with the winds. And I didn't get a chance to do much with the winds at the University of Illinois at all. Mm. And so that was another plus. The other thing that was really wonderful was I was often asked to play concerti with the university orchestra, and that didn't happen at other schools on a frequent basis at all. And as a result, I got to expand my repertoire of playing, because often I would be asked to play a specific piece, and I probably wouldn't have learned it if I didn't know that I had the opportunity of playing it. I probably would have learned just more solo repertoire. So that was very special in my time here. For my farewell, my very last playing as a faculty member took place with the university orchestra.
Oh, really? You
know, I gave a final solo recital, but then I got to play a Beethoven concerto with the university orchestra, which was a pleasant way to round things off, because it was such great music.
Yes. So. Howard, one of the issues that I have heard from alumni of the School of Music that I have met over the years is that the focus on music education, of training music teachers, has declined over the years at the School of Music. Is that your evaluation? Is that in fact true? And if so, is that something to celebrate or to regret?
Well, I think it's something to regret, because it's, you know, having qualified people teaching in school systems throughout the state and elsewhere is very, very important, because if we don't get to our young people, the future of music won't be as wonderful as it has been. And of course, as we all know, art and music are the first things to suffer when there are cutbacks in curricula. I think that the piano contribution to music education in more recent years has been better than it has in the past, because we have been able to hire a couple of truly outstanding people. I mean, today, Jessica Johnson, who is the head of our pedagogy and class piano work, is receiving a Distinguished Teaching Award.
Huh?
And I'm sure it's very, very deserved. And I can't remember anyone in the music department receiving one of those since Alona Combrick received one in the teaching of voice early in my stay here at the university. I think it's very rare. Certainly no pianist, to my recollection, received a Distinguished Teaching Award during my years here. And to know that one is being offered today to this very gifted young person, I think is a feather in our caps. And I think there is a future for music education here in Wisconsin. I have had more applied majors in my class than I've had music education at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably because I've had more gifted students to teach, because when I came, I was asked to help build up the doctoral program, the graduate program.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd say the majority of my successful students have been more in the graduate class. But I've had a core of wonderful undergraduates as well. But I can't say that I've had a wonderful core of music education people. They haven't gravitated to me as much as the applied people.
But it is fair to say then that you think music education is still a legitimate
I never thought it was anything less ever in my teaching at other institutions, because I had certainly more music education people there than I had here.
Howard, if it were up to you, and if money were not an issue, would you like to see the School of Music become a conservatory?
It is a conservatory. Everyone, of course, that is a music major has to take courses outside of the School of Music. But in reality, it is a functioning conservatory of music, you know, on a high level. It's not a matter of becoming one, it just is one.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just a matter of semantics, it's just the name, conservatory instead of School of Music. It's basically the same.
So. Howard, you made reference earlier to a difficult time in the School of Music, which I'm assuming was the 1980s.
Yes.
In terms of the historical record, is there anything you can say about what those challenges were and how they impacted on the school?
Well, it was just, we were led by someone who maybe just had a different attitude than most of us were used to, and we felt we might have been treated not with the respect that we felt we deserved so much. It was someone who was used to maybe teaching more elementary school people, and we had the feeling, or certainly I do, that we were being cheated as if we were children ourselves. So there was a kind of lack of self-respect, and I think the morale of the school had gone down.
Was that Eunice Metzke?
That's right. That's right. But things like that do occur. I mean, we voted her in, and we also voted her in for a second term.
Oh.
But I'd say things were not quite as comfortable during those years. And I don't think they were as comfortable for her as well. But we came out of it, first of all, with a director that was quite good as a contrast to Mr. Nelson, who didn't stay very long because he got a better job at the University of Iowa. You see, the directorship at the School of Music here is usually awarded to a person, a faculty member, who has already had a full-time job. There is no budget to hire someone from the outside, mm-hmm. as there would be in some other departments. And that has worked as a plus and as a disadvantage, because if you have someone that can really turn from a wonderful pedagogue into a wonderful administrator and wants to do that, and that happened, because anyone that takes that job can't do both jobs full time.
Mm-hmm.
So something has to give. And what usually happens is then part of their applied load is taken up by a junior faculty member who might not have the experience, of course, that the older person has. But we've had three different people in the row that have all been, I'd say, very superior.
Mm-hmm.
And we can forget about those days now. I mean, no matter how good or how bad there were, there was always a core here of wonderful students. And I must say, I could overlook things in administration because uh-huh. I was able to work as a functioning musician here at the School of Music.
Howard, one thing that I know that the university does quite a lot is turn to the School of Music for outreach with mm-hmm. alumni, performances around the state and sometimes around the nation. Were you involved in that over the years?
I was involved in some. I would say I wasn't involved as much as I could have been. I just wasn't asked to do that much. I was involved in arts outreach, mostly because my son and the quartet would go out, and they would often ask me to come with them,
uh-huh.
and we would play a quintet or a piano quartet. I played much more with the quartet that was originally here, Norman Polu and Rich Bloom and Martha Bloom and Lowell Kreitz, and then with Perry than I have the more recent years, since the new quartet was here. Of course, Perry reaches over several generations because he's been here since 1976, or I should say, members of the quartet. The permanent members today I've played less with. I don't think I've ever been in a public performance with the quartet, which included David Perry, for instance. I've played with David, but very little.
Howard, you have made reference several times over this interview to the fact that Perry joined the faculty 4 years after you did.
Yes.
And you and he were on the faculty together for 20 or 30 years.
That's right.
Which had to have been a source of great pleasure for you.
Oh, yes. It was just of the highest pleasure. And I think it was a mutually beneficial relationship, and it still is. I mean, I learn so much from him because he's such a superior artist. Yeah. Now that was, we were together for 24 years. You know, he had a job 1 year at the University of British Columbia because the School of Music was not going to support the quartet anymore. I think it was like a year there where there was no support from the school. Yet he continued his position here in performing out of town. Lowell came back into the quartet for the local concerts, and he was able to bring the Pro Arte Quartet to the University of British Columbia, and I got go there and play for him and with the quartet there.
Yes.
There was a bad time. It was Irving Shane, the chancellor at the time, that really saved the quartet. He was a great music lover. I mean, he is a great music lover. He still helps the School of Music out, and we feel very indebted to Irving Shane. And the present chancellor, John Wiley, is a great music lover and a great supporter of the School of Music. I mean, he's the one that has really encouraged us to make recordings, the faculty members to make recordings through the School of Music, and encourages us to apply for grants and so forth. And I think he's very proud of us. I know he's always giving out our recordings to his friends and acquaintances. And even to the people who sell the recordings at the concerts themselves when they buy tickets. He often gives those people recordings. That's out of his own pocket.
John Wiley makes no bones about his affection for music and the School of Music.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. We're very aware of that. No, having Perry as my colleague, of course, has been the great bonus for me here.
That has to be highly unusual.
Very unusual. It's very common for husband and wives to be on the same faculty in more recent years, but to have father and son, that's very different.
Yes, I just have a mental image of father and son sitting together in a faculty meeting.
We often try to sit very far apart.
Yes, I can understand that.
And Perry was always one to, he was never shy about sharing his thoughts about things. And he's still that way. He's a very secure individual, I would say, in what he has to say.
I will share this one image of Perry with you. I traveled with the Pro Arte Quartet a few times when I was a fundraiser with the UW. Perry can work a room and he can perform, put this wonderful performance on with the quartet, and the rest of the quartet will sit quietly during dinner and have a drink afterwards. Not Perry. He's shaking hands. He's telling stories.
Yes,
he's charming. I mean, they're all nice.
Yes.
But Perry was a pleasure to work with. He could have a second career as a fundraiser.
I know. Yeah. He does well with the public.
Yes.
I think David Perry is very soft-spoken.
Yes.
And, you know, when he gives a master class, you really have to listen very hard because you can hardly hear him speak. Now, he has a lot to say because when it comes to playing the violin, he plays it like an angel. There's no one that I've heard in a quartet that is more perfect than David Perry. But as a person, he's just very understated and very soft-spoken. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine him just sitting there and not saying much of anything at times. But when he takes the bow up and puts it on the fiddle, or he can transport one.
Well, I mean, the Priority Quartet is not hired to work the room. It's just a bonus when Perry gets out there. He laughs.
Yes. Yes, it's a very infectious laugh.
Yes.
You know, I can tell if I come into a restaurant if Perry's there or not, because if I hear that laugh, that wonderful laugh, it's just, it's infectious.
Yeah. Yes. Howard, as I think about your career, distinguished and long, and of the many composers you have played and studied, any observations about which ones you like or what it is about their music that attracts you that you're willing to share for posterity?
Well, I would say from the time I was quite young, and most people in music have certain loves, certain attractions that brought them to the art when they were young. And it was basically the romantic spirit that brought me to music. Almost every recital that I heard when I was a youngster included the works of Frédéric Chopin. And I would say that at the time of my youth, his music meant so much to me, and still does. I'm just always amazed at the beauty of what he wrote, and it doesn't pale on me now. I'm not as exclusively in love with him as much as I used to be, but I still admire him, and I admire any pianist that is able to play Chopin truly beautifully. I think he's one of the most difficult composers to play beautifully, simply because of the combination of the technique, which I think is quite intricate, plus the classical restraint that has to be there. Because he was a perfect example of this romantic spirit disciplined by a classical restraint, more so than Schumann, more so than Liszt. Tchaikovsky was a composer that truly brought me to music. I loved almost everything I heard of his, the emotion of it, the maybe it was a lack of sophistication. I don't admire the music, or let me say this, as much as I did, I think I could put it another way. Maybe I don't feel I need it as much as I used to. Oh. But I'd say Bach, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Schubert, those are the composers that I have to put up there. You know, 1, 2, 3, or all ones. They're the supreme composers. And I'm a person of great enthusiasms. And there are composers that I have come across, and I just must know more about them and study them more intensively throughout my life. In more recent years, the works of Karol Szymanowski, the Polish composer, has attracted me no end. And the works of George Enescu, the Romanian composer, mm-hmm. one of the most fantastic musicians, one of the greatest minds of music. I think everything that man studied, he never forgot. He had total recall of everything. He was given by the Queen of Romania the complete works of Bach in the Gesellschaft edition, except for one volume. And he knew the complete works of Bach backwards and forwards for his entire life, except for that one volume that he never was given. It's just fantastic. He was asked if there was some catastrophe in which all the works of Beethoven would suddenly be destroyed. Would he be able to save those works for humanity? Would he be able to? He said no. Only the symphonies, the string quartets, the violin sonatas, the Fidelio, the opera Fidelio, the Mass, the Missa Solemnis. In other words, all the works that he had studied, he could bring back. He had total recall.
Really?
He could play. He didn't need a note. They were in his mind forever. I mean, this was such a phenomenal musician. He was so unusual that it's hard to imagine a single person being able to do all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to envy someone with such a gift. Anyway, I love his music very much, mm-hmm. and he's been more recent. I've always loved the music of a contemporary American composer, Leon Kirshner. He is maybe the one composer who writes in the Schoenbergian style that was influenced by Schoenberg, whose music I unequivocally love. I like to explore byways in music, and right now I've participated in several works.
This is side two of tape four of Howard Karp.
Yes. Well, I love most music, I would say. And I haven't mentioned Brahms. I have an interview with Horowitz, and I've heard him play some beautiful Brahms. The two concerti, I never heard him play a live performance of the first concerto, but I heard a recording that he made with Bruno Walter.
Mm.
I think that was a live performance in the 30s, 1933 or so. But I heard him play the B-flat concerto. And I always loved his Brahms performances. But he said, as he got older, he was... He didn't have the love of his music as he got older that he had when he was younger, which was a real surprise to me, because I haven't felt that at all. I know some people like Louis Kentner has mentioned that Schumann is a composer for one's youth and not for old age, and I haven't found that either,
mm-hmm.
because I'm sure I'm probably older than Louis Kentner was when he made that statement. I have certain regrets. I never got to hear Bartók when I could have. I never got to see Arnold Schoenberg conduct, and I could have.
You have heard Bartók?
Oh, I could have heard Bartók in 1942. He played with the Chicago Symphony.
Uh-huh.
He played a second concerto, which was probably his greatest... his greatest piano work. And I saw this man, this old man, practicing in the basement of Orchestra Hall, dressed in a very, very formally. And I thought to myself, oh, isn't this nice that the Chicago Symphony lets this old man play his piece with them. I thought the Chicago Symphony was doing a favor for this man. And I had no idea how great a person he was. Of course, I was very young. I was probably in the eighth grade, and I was going to concerts though, and I felt very privileged to have grown up in Chicago and to hear all these great artists come through. They had an effect on me. Some musicians don't need that as much as I do. There are some musicians that I have known that are so completely self-sufficient. That they can generate everything from themselves and don't need the inspiration of others playing. But I've always needed it, and I think that's why I tend to gravitate towards concerts,
mm-hmm.
and still find it. There's something very youthful about my attitude in going to concerts. I want to be inspired, and I often am. So I'm happy about that.
Howard, if somebody... hired Carnegie Hall and gave it to you to do a recital, what pieces do you think you would pick to play?
Oh, I think I would try to play some Bach. I think I would love to play Schubert. if there's one composer that perhaps I've tried to explore in depth more than any other composer, it's probably been Schubert. I've just always adored his music, mm-hmm. and the love has become deeper as the years have gone by. I probably play some Liszt, and I probably play something contemporary. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be my ideal if I got to play. I don't think I'll play in Carnegie Hall, but I'll still practice.
Okay, that's right. And we have that on tape.
All right, now. Fine. I want to continue being a practicing musician. I know I've cut down my teaching activities, but I realize that if I have more time now, I really want to spend it in music, and I don't have that many other interests other than reading that I want to explore. I guess the difficulties that I've had with my health in recent years kind of emphasizes the fact that any time that I'm free of medical problems, I want to devote to music. And I'd like to continue playing, and I'd like to continue learning.
I think so, I can speak for your audiences that we look forward to your continuing to play.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. So, and if you'd like sometime for me to play, I will do that. It's just I'm not ready to do that right now. I hope you would understand.
I do indeed. This interview will pick up at a later point to record Howard playing a piece of his choosing or a portion of that. But this concludes the verbal portion of the interview, and it is a privilege for me to acknowledge Professor Howard Karp and his life and career. Thank you, Howard,
so much.
Appreciate
it, Bob.